Hello and welcome to Women in AI Breaking the Mold. I'm your host, Marcy Garnhill, and today we have Ana Matran Fernandez, a lecturer in Artificial Intelligence and Neural Engineering at University of Essex.
Hello, Ana. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, I'm very happy to be here.
How are you today?
I'm very good. Just about to start teaching this week, so good timing.
Oh, that's nice.
How about you? You're okay?
Yeah, not too bad. Thankfully, it's very sunny here today, so I'm enjoying it right now.
Lucky. Doesn't stop raining over there, so here it's raining. So yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Okay. The UK, what can you do?
That is very true. So just to start things off, could you just tell our listeners a little bit about your professional background?
Yeah, sure. So I am currently a lecturer in Artificial Intelligence and Neural Engineering in the University of Essex. And to get here, my background as an undergrad, I did telecommunications engineering. I got started there with brain signals and kind of started getting a feel for machine learning, even though I didn't know it was machine learning at the time. I did a biomedical engineering master's here in the UK. That was my first experience abroad, I guess. And then I came back to the UK to do my PhD in computer science and electronic engineering. So after all of that, after doing a PhD, you do a postdoc, as one does, and eventually got up where I am via a secondment. So a trial period in the Institute for Analytics and Data Science. So that gave me a bit more of an overview of not just what us academics are doing and the research that we do, but also in AI, but also what companies do. So I kind of have a bit of both backgrounds in that way.
Oh, that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing. It's just such an interesting journey you had so far. It all sounds very complicated to me, but it also sounds very interesting.
Well, I agree. I don't think it's as complicated as it sounds. But yeah, people do that a lot, especially when I mention brain computer interfaces, which I haven't mentioned yet. But as soon as you say, yeah, brain and computer interface, and they're like, what's that? And that's when people kind of start getting even more interested in what I do, I guess.
Because it is very interesting. So I guess my next question is just, what was your journey into AI? Like, you've covered a little bit about your background, but when did you realize it was something you were just going to focus on with your studies and work?
I think it was, in a way, a bit by accident. So I had done, without knowing I was doing machine learning, I had done some classification for my dissertation in my undergrad and my master's. But I didn't know that was machine learning. It was just decision trees for me, or random forests. But then basically during the year between my master's and my PhD, Coursera, this online platform that now has every single course under the world, under the sun, now, back then it had three courses. One was called Artificial Intelligence, one was called Machine Learning, and the other one was Introduction to the Databases, I think. So I had a kind of gap year. It wasn't really a gap year. I was trying to find a job without really knowing what I wanted to do. And while I was doing that, I did those three courses. And that's when I really realized the potential and implications that this had. But I saw machine learning mostly as a tool to do what I wanted to do, which at that point was brain-computer interfaces. And it's something that you needed in order to basically classify mental states from different people based on their brain signals. So I didn't really get into machine learning as an actual field. It was more of a tool for the applications that I was working on.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it just leads to my next question. What's the biggest challenge you think you faced or are still facing in your AI journey?
In my specific journey, I think there's two aspects. One of them is, in a way, it's a good thing, but at the same time, it makes things very, very challenging for a lot of people, which is the fact that research in AI has exploded in the last, I'm going to say 5 years. I don't really have a specific timeline, but The big conferences are getting bigger. It's impossible to, your research basically gets lost in a sea of research from lots of other people. So it gets very difficult to get your results out there and to get people to know them and to interact with them. So I think that's one of the things. And the other thing from my specific research is it's not necessarily machine learning. It's the actual tools that I have to work with. So the hardware that I use for brain-computer interfaces. It's just the signals are not as clean as we wish they were. But that's a limitation of, I mean, that's also what makes it interesting. So I think that's those are kind of the two main things that I have to work with at the moment.
Yes, and it's interesting you mentioned how much publishing there is out there, because whenever I have a look, there's just so many and it's so different and some things are just so specific. It can really feel like it's easy to just get lost in the middle of everything.
That's one of the things. The other thing is, well, in academic research, when you're trying to publish, someone has to look at your paper and has to basically give you feedback and tell you whether they think it's good enough to be published or not. So there's a lot more competition, and that's one of the issues. So getting the papers out is an issue, but also because at the end of the day, the pool of reviewers, or the people who can actually look at your work and decide whether it's good enough or not, we're all overworked. I think that's a third problem we have that is not specifically machine learning. It's more academic research. We're all so overworked that it gets really hard. So to find the time to do this, which is at the end of the day, one of the things that we would all love to be doing more. It's another bottleneck that there's at the moment.
I completely understand. I know a few people who've done PhDs, and the overworked part, I think, always comes in.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Yes. Thank you for that. So looking on the other side of things, what aspects of AI have excited you the most?
So lately, one of the things that I'm most excited about is in the field of causal inference. I was going to say causal interface. Causal inference. So basically, one of the things that's kind of trending or is starting to take off now in AI is basically systems being able to make inferences that are not just correlational. So much of the research that's done at the moment, and many of the, you know, deep learning that we see, is based on the correlations between the features that we're feeding to the system. So the inputs that we have for a neural network. And at the moment, there's a lot of work on bias and causal inference that's just looking at not necessarily having the best performance ever, because at the end of the day, if you can't explain why, your system might be getting it completely wrong. So a typical example was that I give my students is there were some images of tanks camouflaged in a forest. So what they did was they took some pictures on a sunny day in which there were tanks hidden in the forest. And then another day they went and they took the pictures without the tanks hiding in the forest. And the difference was that the first day, in addition to the tanks, the other main difference was that one of the days it was sunny, the other one it was cloudy. So the network learned to distinguish between cloudy and sunny days, not between tanks and no tanks. So yeah, it's whereas if you look at causal inference, I think one of the cool things is that it a lot of the data that we work with is observational rather than coming from randomized control trials. So if we think in terms of medicine, so will this aspirin work for your headache or will it not? So in causal inference, we're looking at the effect of the treatment being the aspirin, without having to have necessarily randomized controlled trials in which some people are giving the aspirin, some people are not giving the aspirin, and we see in which ones it works and in which ones it doesn't. So that's something I'm really interested in, especially because of the potential it has to address the issues of bias in AI, which are, as I'm sure you and your audience know, everywhere. Yes. At the moment. So, yeah.
Yes. Oh, thank you for that. Yes, so I'd also like to know how everything that you've just, well, not everything, but what you've just said that excites you about AI, how would you say that's transferred to the work you're doing right now, or the research, or the teaching, or just anything else?
Okay, so the research I do is not necessarily in that field. I want to get a bit more in that field, but I do work with women in computer science groups. So we're trying to get more girls interested in coming and working in computer science, specifically in AI. I think it's very important. And I think this field of, you know, bias in AI, it's one of the good ways, or one of the important ways, that we have to show them that we need them there, which is, it's been proven that when teams are more diverse, and when we have more women, more people of color, and it's not just, you know, the stereotypical white young male, heterosexual white young male in California creating the systems. When teams are more diverse than that, and we have multiple perspectives and multiple points of view, then the systems that the teams come up with are much better and much less biased. So that's one of the things why that's one of the reasons why I think that's a very important thing. The other thing that I do is, so specifically with my students, my master's students, which I think will be some of the data scientists of the future, because that's what I teach, data science. I think it's very important to have that conversation in terms of, it's not just accuracy that matters. It's, you know, how's your system performing in situations where it hasn't seen, you know, it has to make a difference about that type of thing that it hasn't seen before. What is it going to be basing that decision on? And is it being fair to all the groups? The problem is that I think we've been conditioned for so long to just think in terms of the performance of the classifier, that they don't, it's really difficult to get them in that mindset of, if I lose 2% accuracy, but all these groups are not being disadvantaged anymore, then that's definitely worth it. And that's something that needs to be explored. But it's something I struggle with every year to get them to think about. So, but yeah, I think it's very important. I think it's necessary for the data science of the future. I think we need to be trained in that way.
Yes, thank you. That's very interesting. And I was wondering, since you also mentioned the future, what did you say, at least in your field, what can you see AI maybe not changing or revolutionizing, but just what do you think we can expect in the next few years?
So in specifically in brain computer interfaces, I think the future is in having systems that are kind of plug and play. So in a brain computer interface, you need, at the moment, you need your user to be training for a while. And that means that, just like a normal machine learning system needs some inputs that it can predict on, and the internal parameters are trained on that. For a BCI, which has a classifier or a regressor inside, we also need that data. But that data, in our case, is in the form of brain signals. So we need to collect the brain signals. We change a lot depending on the person, depending on the time of the day. Even within a person and a day, before and after coffee makes a difference. If you're tired, it makes a difference. So I hope that in the future, AI can help us with generalizing. So we're dealing with the data shift that we have at the moment with this type of signals, which by their own nature, there's going to be data shift. So the question is whether AI can help us address it, so that by the time the person wants to use the brain computer interface, they don't have to start from scratch and train it from the beginning. Because depending on what our target user is, if we're talking about people who, the main reason why brain computer interfaces were developed was for people who couldn't communicate at all, they were completely locked in. At most, you might have some residual eye movement, but if we look at the proper definition of locked in, they can't even do that. So the brain is intact, but there's no pathway to anywhere else in the body. They have no control. So if we have that type of person, we cannot have them training half an hour every day to be able to use it for another maybe half an hour. I don't think it's reasonable. So my hope is that AI will help with that kind of plug and play interface. So for that, we also need more data sets. So collecting data from more participants, making it available, which I'm working on at the moment with some colleagues. So I think that's my hope for the future and how AI can help.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing your insights. And you mentioned earlier about how it's important to make sure we've got essentially a more diverse AI field. So do you have any tips for other women or maybe girls that are thinking about working in AI?
It's not a tip, it's more of a do it. You have to do it. I think at the end of the day, AI is, it's everywhere. It's I don't want to say controlling our lives, but if we think in terms of recommender systems, it's been proven that the things we see on Facebook, on Twitter, social media in general, they shape our minds, they shape how we think. Who's developing those systems? Not the women. And I'm very worried about what can happen and what's already happened in the past. So think that as a person who's potentially thinking of joining AI, I think thinking in terms of, you know, you would be helping shape the future of, you know, the new generations that are coming behind, that are coming next. I think from that perspective of these people are in a way, these systems, not these people, these systems are currently in a way shaping who you are. And we're talking again about white heterosexual men. Do we want those people to control who we are, or do we want to, you know, create an alternative version of that, a better version of that, I think.
Thank you so much for that. And with that, time isn't really on our side here, so I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up things now. Anna, it's been amazing having you here. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, before we end things, I just thought to add, if our listeners are interested in what you're doing, if they want to reach out and hear more about what you're doing right now, what's the best place for them to find you, if that's okay with you?
Yeah, it's absolutely fine. I think probably one of the best ways is Twitter. I'm also on LinkedIn. Emails I always reply to. So yeah, I'm happy to share those with you so you can put in somewhere and yeah, people can reach out.
Will do.
Always happy.
Oh, fantastic. So thank you so much for coming again, and hope everyone has a nice day. And you too, Anna.
You too. Thank you very much.